Welcome to episode 281 of the Seahawkers podcast. I'm Brandon Schultz of the Military Seahawkers, joined by my good buddy and Montana Seahawker, Adam Emmert.
Hey, it's nice to join you on a victory podcast, a playoff victory podcast. Even though it's a little sloppy, a little messy, a little tough to watch at times, a victory is a victory.
A victory is a victory. They come away with a 17-9 win over the Philadelphia Eagles. Twice in the same season, they finished with the same score. And it's kind of fitting that that number keeps coming up, because the last time the Seahawks played the Green Bay Packers, the score was 17-9. And now they're playing the Green Bay Packers coming up next weekend.
I didn't know that about the Packers. That is even odder, because what a weird score. Like 17-9 is an odd score. You don't see that very often, let alone twice against the same team in the same year. I guess that's how you know that it wasn't a fluke that the Seahawks won against the Eagles, just because they've done it exactly the same way twice as far as the score is concerned.
Yeah.
The way the game unraveled a little bit, not exactly the same. It was definitely a different game.
It was definitely a different game, and a big part of it, well, one, Carson Wentz wasn't in the game for very long, goes out with injury, ends up with a concussion early on in the game. We'll probably get into that with the Jadeveon Clowney hit, and that brought on Josh McCown, who does not turn over the football at all. So where the Seahawks really got a lot of turnovers in the last game with Carson Wentz giving up the ball, now they were forced to do it on their own. And luckily with Russell Wilson and DK Metcalf had 35 yards in that first game against the Eagles. And this game was the DK Metcalf show.
Nice coming out party for the young man. And I mean, I think at this point is the time when we can really say, wow, what a draft pick. Like, just so much better than all of us really, well, maybe not all of us really hoped for, but I think what we had hoped for, I mean, we'd hoped for something much lesser than this and would have been excited about that as like being a big contribution. And boy, he played yesterday like a true number one receiver in this league. That was unbelievably exciting to watch, and the way that Russell trusted him. Just kudos to him, man, and all the hard work he's put in and just kind of connecting with Russ and coming through as a rookie in the playoffs. I mean, most guys are hitting the rookie wall weeks before this. So just hats off to DK.
And he's looking better than ever at this point in the season. Let's go back. Let's go through it. I do have some highlights to play from this game, courtesy of Steve Raybould, Seahawks Radio Network. And the way this game started off, you know, the Seahawks trying to run the ball. They did that against Dallas. They finished the day with 17 rushes with their running backs. They only get 19 yards. One of those plays was pretty significant that we're going to get into. But, you know, not a lot of running room for the running backs. And Travis Homer, what was it on, like, I think his first carry of the game, he ends up putting it on the ground, fortunately able to recover it. But not a good day overall for Travis Homer, just 12 yards on 11 carries.
Well, one thing that we've been talking about a little bit going down the stretch here is Pete Carroll and Brian Schottenheimer and their inability to adapt. And it's something that we saw at the end of last year. You brought up the Dallas game. Great example. We all were flummoxed by that, seeing that we couldn't run the ball at all. And yet wouldn't just turn it over to Russ when he was the only thing that was successful in that game offensively. And you saw them actually go ahead and, you know, focus on the passing game and rely on Russell, especially early on. I mean, really the run pass ratio is kind of evened out closer towards the end of the game when they were just trying to run the clock out and just get the hell out of there with a win. And Russ really did. I mean, you said it was the DK Metcalf show in this game. I mean, it was the Russell Wilson show, because that offensive line was an absolute dumpster fire yesterday, and Russ still managed to put on a show. And it's really, this was a playoff game that Russell Wilson basically won on his own.
He did. And I think he accounted for like 95% of the yardage on the day, which, you know, that's what you expect. That's, I know what I expected going into the playoffs, that if the Seahawks were going to go far in the playoffs, it was going to be on the back of Russell Wilson. So I'm glad to see the Seahawks putting it in his hands. And Tyler Lockett was a part of it too. It wasn't just Russell to DK, and it was Russell Wilson hitting Tyler Lockett early on in this game that helped move the sticks and pick up a 29-yard gain.
Blitz coming. Russ, look out. Now he's going to slide left. Now he's going to throw it up over the top. Lockett, what a catch! No, couldn't keep his feet in bounds. Unbelievable twisting, turning Tyler Lockett just could not get his feet down as Russ was rolling left side and had to fire that ball before he got hit on the blitz by the Eagles. Now, Pete has thrown the challenge flag. He might have actually got both feet in.
After review, the receiver possessed the ball with 2 feet in bounds and maintained control while going to the ground.
We want a challenge.
Yeah, we want a challenge. And come on, Philly fans. Like, I get that there's going to be a certain amount of fans at every stadium that when the call doesn't go their way, they're going to boo. But that was the whole entire stadium. And it's like, did you look on the Jumbotron at all?
Yeah.
I mean, it's clearly a catch. Stop your whining. Holy cow, the amount of Philly fans whining after this game. Give me a break. Number one, what a bunch of crybaby catfish asses. Like, that, it's pretty pathetic on their part at this point. But yeah, that was an amazing catch by Tyler. And that was the second play in a row where the refs were trying to screw us out of what was rightfully ours. I mean, they called a push off on Jacob Hollister on the play before that. The amount of contact that was there is never called. Never called. Then the next play, Tyler does the tiptoe dance there, makes the catch. Nope, incomplete. Well, thank goodness we can challenge that and keeps the drive alive.
Yeah, that is never called. And we saw it not called early on in the day, the very last play of the game between the Vikings and the Saints, where Kirk Cousins throws the ball up to his tight end, Kyle Rudolph, in the end zone. And you do see if that was more of a push off by Rudolph and it was a non-call, and they reviewed right. it and because it was a scoring play and they let it stand. So I have no idea where the consistency is. If they're going to call that on Hollister, you got to call pass interference on Kyle Rudolph on that touchdown in the Vikings game.
Right. My thought would be this. I would rather them not call that on Hollister and then also not call that on Rudolph
right.
the way that they did. Because, man, come on, Saints fans. I understand Saints fans have like battered fan syndrome going on right now. And like they've just been screwed over and over again by the refs in the playoffs. This time you weren't screwed. So you're going to have to let it go. That was the right call. But as far as that Hollister push off, quote unquote, that was just good offensive gameplay there. Tyler really did come through in this game with a lot of big catches, and that one probably being the most spectacular one, the little toe tap there.
Tyler Lockett, 4 catches, 62 yards, targeted 8 times total on the day. And we saw a 38-yard catch by David Moore. That was a big third down catch by him. But the guy on third down in this game was DK Metcalf. You know, he had a 28-yard catch that led to the Seahawks' first 49-yard field goal. He had a 26-yard catch on third down that led up to the Marshawn Lynch touchdown. And then he had this catch on third and 10 that led the team to be able to kneel down for the final seconds of the game.
Blitz is coming. Russ is going to let it fly. He's got Metcalf deep. Metcalf reaches up. He makes the catch near midfield. What a play call by the Seahawks. Just throw it deep. And Metcalf makes the catch. He has been spectacular today. And the Seahawks now can use up this last time out of the Eagles and can run this clock down.
Wyman Chuckles brought to you by Dave Wyman.
And there they are. Yes, those were fun to listen to. And DK giving the whole Philly crowd the deuces after that catch was pretty great. I love that.
You know why? Do you know why he gave them the deuces? Because almost every Philly fan there was giving him the double birds.
Oh, well, that seems about right. And look, that wasn't even his biggest play of the game. I mean, he failed to mention the touchdown grab.
Goes in motion. Russell play fake. Now he's going to throw down the middle. Got a man. Metcalf makes the catch diving. He is in for a touchdown. Seahawks, what a play by the rookie DK Metcalf. Gets in behind the secondary. Makes a diving catch, hits the ground, gets back up, and then drags a defender to the end zone. 53 yards. What a play by number 14. Simply spectacular. And the Seahawks lead by 10.
Yeah, that's the one, man. That's one it. Right there. That was a spectacular catch. That was way better than the one to seal the game. You know, sealing the game is nice and all, but holy smokes, to lay out like he did, then have the presence of mind to get back up, and then just go full-on wide receiver beast mode and drag dude into the end zone, that got me off my couch for sure. There was some flexing in the living room with my little white man muscles, and it was awesome. I definitely enjoyed that a ton. And that kind of felt like the, oh, DK Metcalf is going to be a beast in these playoffs moment. Like, it was a coming out party almost in my mind. I don't know how it felt for you.
Yeah, it did. And I mean, 160 yards by the rookie, that's an NFL record. And as great as the touchdown was, he was clutch in three key third down moments. And it wasn't just, you know, catching a slant for just getting a barely a first down. Mm-hmm. It was a 26 yard catch on third down, a 28 yard catch on third down. And then the last one was for 36 yards.
Yeah, he's definitely the number one deep threat right now for the Seahawks, with teams really concentrating on making sure Lockett doesn't get over the top on him. I mean, that's, you can see that's exactly how the Eagles wanted to play it. They're like, all right, let the rookie beat us. And he did. And I mean, of course, he's one of the big stories of the game, and it's all fun and everything. But the story of the game is Russell Wilson. Like, that's what I feel like nobody's really talking about.
Right.
Like, it's all DK Metcalf and who got the ball to DK. It was Russell Wilson. And how was he doing it? He was running for his freaking life. And if he wasn't running for his life, he was taking the snap and standing in there and delivering strikes and getting destroyed. Like, this is the reason why they don't just put the game in Russell's hands all the time, like all the pundits want us to do. We'll just put it in Russell's hands. Why don't they just put it in Russell's hands? I don't understand why they just don't put it in Russell's hands. That's why, right there, he gets destroyed. He got hit probably 20 times in that game. I mean, just in big hits, too. But he stood in the pocket. He delivered darts. He picked up yardage with his feet when we needed it. He was the leading rusher, like you mentioned. Russell Wilson was flat astounding in this game.
You know what? You bring up a good point, because it does feel like, I think that this is just expected from him at this point. And that's why he's not getting the credit. And DK Metcalf, you know, him being a rookie, that's an unexpected thing from him. So the fact that Russell Wilson just went out and got it done and is getting almost no credit at all, I think it speaks exactly to that, that people just expect it from Russell this point. That's why, you know, he should be the MVP of the league. He only got the three all-pro votes for first team. So you expect he's probably not going to get the MVP, but this is why. This is an MVP type performance, and it's why the Seahawks won the game.
It's absolutely why the Seahawks won the game. Without him, they would be nowhere. And it's just, it was astounding to me how well he played and just how poorly the offensive line played. I mean, Joey Hunt, Jones, and Fant, that's a recipe for disaster against the likes of Fletcher Cox. I mean, if there's one thing that I learned in this game, for sure, is that Joey Hunt cannot be our long-term solution at center. I know he's probably not in the minds of John Schneider and everything, but by God, like, Fletcher Cox just mauled him all game.
Yeah.
He had no chance. No chance. And that was the scary part, was watching somebody like Fletcher Cox just dominate the game.
Yeah, I don't know how they measure pressures and things in this game, because I'm looking at the pressure numbers from the playoffs, and it's showing that Russell Wilson only got hit twice. He got hit more than twice in this game.
Where are you getting that number?
I'm looking at the Pro Football Focus stats.
Really? Did they watch it with blindfolds?
It says the only two guys that allowed quarterback hits, one from Jacob Hollister, one from Joey Hunt.
Both.
Catfish!
That can't be right.
Yeah, I wish I would have gone through now and marked every time Russell Wilson hit the freaking deck.
Yeah.
But it was definitely more than twice. It was closer to 10 to 15.
Well, especially when you consider the fact that he had, you know, well, it was 9 rushes on the day, but that's with the 3. So he ran 6 times.
Yeah.
But he did a good job of getting down and not taking hits on those particular runs.
When he was running. Yeah, when he was running. I'm talking about every time that he stood in the pocket and delivered and got crushed.
Yeah, that can't be right. Those numbers can't be right.
Yeah, immediate pressure at all times. I mean, hell, Fletcher Cox damn near took the handoff from Marshawn.
And how about Marshawn Lynch? You know, it's he did get stuffed in the backfield on that particular play, and he only finishes the day with 6 carries for 7 yards, but he got a touchdown, and the touchdown was spectacular.
To the line of scrimmage, Marshawn Lynch in the backfield. He takes a handoff. He stops. He cuts back inside down to the. He's still in. He's in for a touchdown. Marshawn Lynch, touchdown, Seahawks. He was stopped at the 1, spun out of a tackle, and kept those legs driving from 5 yards out. And beast mode helped the Seahawks extend the lead to 9-3.
That was so vintage and so amazing to watch. I mean, that's why you have him here. Right now, what we need from Marshawn is a handful of those big, imposing plays in a game. I mean, I don't need him to carry it 25 times, right? Like, that's not why he's here. But give me 5 to 6 vintage beast mode plays. And he gave us at least 3.
Yeah.
The touchdown run, there was a swing pass to the left to where, and it wasn't a big gain. It was only like 5 or 6 yards, but Malcolm Jenkins came over to kind of finish him off. And Beast, like, just stiff-armed him to the ground, just threw him to the ground one-handed.
I think that one was LeBlanc, yeah.
No, yeah, LeBlanc was on the right side on the screen pass, or it wasn't a screen pass, but a flare pass to Marshawn, where he actually did gain significant yardage, and then he took LeBlanc and threw him on the ground like a rag doll, one-handed, too. And then the Beast mode run right there. I mean, those were 3 attitude plays, and it makes a big difference.
And Jenkins got it again on that touchdown run, because that was, you know, I see people giving some credit to Fluker. He was in there mixing it up, but it was Marshawn spinning out of the Malcolm Jenkins tackle and throwing him to the ground kind of in that pile. I wish it would have been a little bit clearer, but yeah, Malcolm Jenkins, he had took a couple shots from Marshawn in this game.
He sure did. And those are attitude plays, man. And that's what this team needs. That's what we needed, that energy from him. I mean, that's why the Cardinals game was so deflating. I mean, just seeing the team with no energy and then bringing him back for the Niners game, and you can see how it's infected everything. And it's just awesome. I noticed Pete Carroll saying that after 2 games now, Marshawn feeling really good and that he's ready for a full load, quote unquote.
Right.
I'm wondering, and I don't want to get ahead, like, we can still talk about the Eagles game, but I just wanted to bring this up. We talked a little bit about Marshawn coming back and what that could mean. And we were like, okay, Russ wins us a game. And then we go on the road somewhere. And then we have a vintage Marshawn Lynch beast mode where he tears everything up game. And then we end up in the NFC Championship game. And it's kind of setting up that way. Imagine going to Green Bay with Upati back at left guard. And there's also talk of Duane Brown being able to be back at left tackle.
Yeah, Brock Huard on Twitter saying that he's calling it now that Brown's going to be back and playing in this game.
That would be amazing. So think about the idea of the offensive line now being intact against a team that I don't believe is as good against the run as the Eagles, yet I haven't looked it up or anything like that.
No, they're nowhere near. No, I think even if you look at DVOA, they're in maybe the bottom 10 in the league, like right around 2022.
Okay, there we go. And so you pair that with a Green Bay defense not great against the run, and Marshawn now having 2 games back, conditioning coming back, looking good, and Pete Carroll obviously very impressed with what he's seeing. It all kind of sets up for that big-time beast mode game in Lambeau, of all places, right?
Yeah.
And it's just kind of exciting.
It's exciting, but is it worth it? Like, as a fan, is it worth it having to listen to all these references now to the Super Bowl and Super Bowl 49? I feel like we should be over it by now, but
what Super Bowl?
I can't help but hear and just the announcers are driving this point into the ground that Marshawn's back and going back to referencing the Super Bowl.
What Super Bowl?
49.
I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think the announcers must be drunk. Is really what the problem is, because I don't remember any of that. But
no.
All I know is that he's back, he's ours again, and he looks like Marshawn. It all kind of sets up for a potential big game next week. But they weren't going to get it done this week on the ground, and that was blatantly obvious from the word jump. And I'm so glad that they put it in Russell's hands.
And it really did have to do with the offensive line. When I saw that Mikey Potty wasn't playing, I knew Brown wasn't going to play. But then when you're relying on Fant and Jamarco Jones on the left side and Joey Hunt in the middle, who was having trouble against this Philadelphia defensive line. I mean, when he goes up against elite dudes in the middle, Joey Hunt's getting beat a few times a game. And that's just going to be the way it is. And it has to do with his size. I mean, he's a guy who tries real hard. And I like Joey Hunt a lot.
Good technique, tries hard. He's just not big.
Yeah. And there's nothing that he can do about that. That's just the way he is. Fluker even had a couple tough plays. So, yeah, on the offensive line, it was Strugglesville.
Now, According to Pro Football Focus, the best pass blocker on the Seahawks this last game was Jermaine Ifedi. So let that wash over you for a second. And then also, I mean, just the false starts. I got to have two FU Ifedi moments in that game. Like, where it's just like, oh, I guess we'll have a false start here for no reason. Between him and Hollister, I mean, they tried to kill four drives between them.
I was going to say, I don't remember yelling at Ifedi as much as I do Hollister with his, you know, not being able to stay put when the Philly defensive line was shifting.
Just watch the ball.
Right.
Just watch the ball. You're on the outside of the formation. That's what you do on the road. You can't hear the snap count. You watch the ball. That's what you're supposed to do. It's very simple.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then how about, all right, if we're going to talk about things that were frustrating this game, how about what point was it in the game? It was after the Eagles turned it over on downs the first time. We go to TV timeout. We come back from TV timeout, and there they are lined up with the play clock already down to like five. Russell is in La La Land doing who knows what, like screwing around with his mouthpiece. And they snap the ball, bounces right off his chest. He manages to recover, but we needed to score on that drive to like feel good going down the stretch here. And they just bungled the whole thing. Again, coming out of a TV timeout. Like, this is reminiscent of last week.
Totally killed that drive.
Yeah. Frustrating.
I was frustrated when the officials didn't see an obvious offside call on the Philadelphia defense. And Russell throws it down into, what was it, double, triple cover? There are all kinds of Eagles down there.
Yeah, he thought it was a free play.
He thought it was a free play, and it should have been a free play. And he nearly got it picked off.
Yeah, that was tough as well. And look, the one thing that did work in our favor is Carson Wentz exiting the game early and, you know, basically having Josh McCown come off the couch to come in and play quarterback, yet was still relatively elusive somehow.
Yeah, outrunning Ziggy Ansah to the outside on a play where Ansah ends up injuring his neck and not able to return to the game. So Ansah goes out. But, you know, was McCown... was that a difference in the game, not having McCown versus not having Wentz? Because as we pointed out before, the final score was the exact same. You know, the Eagles still only able to put up 9 points. The injuries that they're dealing with, you know, it wasn't just at the quarterback spot. It was their entire right side of their line with their Pro Bowler Brooks out and Lane Johnson out as the right tackle. Mm-hmm. So we were missing our entire left side. They're missing their entire right side. And then wide receivers, you know, they're down to nobody. You had Zach Ertz trying to play with broken ribs, and Dallas Goedert was their leading tight end, leading receiver overall.
It made a huge difference once wasn't in there. There was definitely a couple spots there that McCown just flat out missed, either Ertz or Goedert, that would have kept drives alive and them moving down the field. I think bigger than the Wentz thing, though, is Doug Peterson. Like, I don't understand for the life of me what he was doing down the stretch there at the end of that game. Why on earth aren't you kicking field goals there? That doesn't make any sense to me. Look, it's Josh McCown. Your offensive line is decimated. Your wide receivers are gone.
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing going for it on fourth down in both those spots? Let me put it to you this way. They kick field goals instead of going for it on fourth down there, let's say.
Yeah.
Okay? Uh-huh. Make them both. Now you're down, what would that put you at, 12, 15? You're down by a point or 2 points.
Right.
17, 15, right? You instead, maybe, just maybe, you don't give up that bomb to DK Metcalf. And
you're getting the ball back.
You get the ball back down, too. Like, I don't, especially with good field position, I don't get it. I'd be livid if I was an Eagles fan.
Adam, Doug Peterson is an analytics guy. The analytics say... the analytics don't put into perspective the personnel issues that you have going on. It doesn't take into account that you have a couple offensive linemen out. It doesn't account for the fact that you're on your backup quarterback. The analytics say, no matter what, that in those fourth down situation, that going for it gives you your best chance to win. And that's what they're going by. And that's, I think, where some of the fault is with the analytics. Now, if they pick up those couple plays, then yeah, they're probably fine. But yeah, if I were an Eagles fan, I'd be saying, hey, why aren't we going for field goals in those situations, especially considering, you know, the fact that you're in the red zone. And yeah, maybe you are considering the fact that you're not going to get back down there. But in hindsight, you look at it and you go, just play to take the points.
And the Seahawks offense had done diddly poo in the second half. I mean, we couldn't get anything going.
No, you had the one touchdown in the third quarter.
Yeah.
And then it was punt in the two drives in the fourth quarter.
Yeah. So I would definitely play to the strength of my team at that point. And you're right about the analytics. They do point to going for it in those situations. But, you know, to further your point, yes, they don't take into account all of the situational football things. Which unit on your team is playing better? What, you know, is the opposing offense doing anything right now? Who do you have out on the field? Like, it just doesn't make sense in any way, shape, or form. And that's why you got to blend those two things, you know, the actual football experience and the analytics. And I guess maybe if you're Doug Peterson and you've built your head coaching career on just being a gambler and going for it and having big balls, that's what you do, I guess. But it really shot him in the foot.
It didn't work out this time. And I think that's what analytics points to, is the fact that it may not work out every time, but in the long run, you're going to win more than you lose. And maybe you take it and you say, well, hey, we won a Super Bowl with it. And so that's what we're going to keep doing. That's going to be the identity of our team. And then you're just going to end up with games like this where you end up losing. And you just, like you said, you hope that it works out more than it doesn't.
You know why Bill Belichick has the identity in a football team with an identity that they just always win? Because they don't give a crap how they do it. They just want to win every single time. Whatever makes the most sense in the moment, situational football-wise, that's what they'll go by. Whether it's what the analytics tell you to do, whether it's what your gut tells you to do, they always just do the best thing in that situation. That's the way that I would want to run my football team.
Unfortunately, there's not a lot of coaches. It's a pretty short list of coaches that can operate in that way and be successful, always, you know, for the most part, almost always making the right decision.
How is that? How is that true?
Because there's professional coaches on both sides of the ball trying to make their best decision at all times, and players on the field trying to make the best plays all the time.
But for every Belichick, there's a dozen Freddie Kitchens, you know, Doug Marones, Jason Garrett's. Like, how are there this many bad head coaches at just being like, oh, this is the best thing to do here?
It's because one of them cheats a lot.
All right, fine. Let's take let's take Belichick out of the equation. Who's the next best head coach in the NFL then? Pete?
Well, yeah, you would
Andy
say
Reed?
Pete, but Pete isn't exactly the best at some of those situational decisions.
No. Harbaugh? Maybe John Harbaugh would be the guy you'd think of.
Harbaugh I'd point to. Sean Payton you maybe point to in some situations.
Yeah, so so for every John Harbaugh, how is there a dozen crap-ass coaches that can't figure out situational football?
I think part of it has to do with this idea of always trying to find the best coordinators to take over as coaches. And when you look at Harbaugh, he wasn't a coordinator. He was a coach. He was a special teams coach.
Yeah.
And I think the difference is teams should be looking for coaches rather than just hiring the guy who coordinates the best, because
they are. Okay.
But they're in that position of offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator, because they can coordinate well. You know, they've moved up the ranks and they can call plays well, and that's why they're in that particular position. But, you know, maybe they aren't the best at managing the entire game.
Yeah. Do you think?
But I don't know how you get experience with that apart from being the head coach.
So I wonder, so do you think just by being a defensive specialist more or an offensive specialist more, that when you do become head coach, you have more tunnel vision for that side of the football? Is that kind of the idea here?
That's where my mind is kind of going.
Okay. I mean, I'm not saying you're wrong. I was just trying to make sure I understood where you're coming from.
Yeah.
I think there's a valid point there. But my thought to that is, if let's say you're a guy by the name of, who's the next hot shot? Well, Josh McDaniels, let's say.
Sure.
All right. Like, he's the hot name for every head coaching position, right? If I'm Josh McDaniels and I'm really good at my job as an offensive coordinator, I can probably do my job very, very well and also carve out 4 hours a week to go and sit in on the defensive meetings, right?
Mm-hmm.
To just be more well-rounded, to understand the mentality of the players playing on that side of the ball, number one, and schemes and situational football from a defensive mindset. You would think that more guys would do that, but it doesn't seem to be the case. I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah, or you would think that in the at the professional ranks, you would find a college coach who is really good at managing those in-game type decisions and managing players, then you could bring them up to the NFL. But we see so often that a lot of those college coaches, their management style works with college players, but not with grown men.
Right. It's definitely a different sport. And I guess the other thing about the idea of situational football being so poorly coached in the NFL right now that is kind of mind-blowing to me is that these are all professional football players. This is what they do, right? They eat, drink, sleep football. That's what they're doing. That is their job. So you would think that the basics and just the ins and outs of the plays and that sort of thing would all be second nature. Like, that's something we shouldn't have to work on that much. Like, that should be something we all have down because we're professionals.
Right.
So now every week of practice, you would think would be spent on, okay, let's practice goal line. Let's practice last 2 minutes of a game. Let's practice onside kicks. Let's practice, just things of that nature. Let's practice getting to the line of scrimmage very quickly after a questionable play that went our way. Mm-hmm. You would think that that would be something that was what you would work on 90% of the time. And then maybe a couple plays by the opponent that you know would come in big moments.
And screen passes,
which obviously they worked on because they did a pretty good job against it.
Yeah, the Seahawks did well against it, and you knew it was coming in this game against Philly. And, you know, we kind of glossed over the Wentz injury a little bit. The McCown did come in, and, you know, he was relatively effective. But, you know, Wentz going down, and Philly fans, holy smokes, the vitriol coming through. You would think that Jadeveon Clowney ear-holed Carson Wentz on that tackle. Because it went for me. Watching the reaction to it was like, oh, well, Carson Wentz, you know, he just has to go to the tent, get checked out. He'll be right back. You know, Eagles mm-hmm. fans were like, yeah, this is going to be the shortest concussion test ever. He's going to be fine and be back out there. Mm-hmm. To them, every single time you saw the replay, and because it happened so early in the game, I think we saw the replay of that collision probably 20 times. And by the end of the game, you were convinced that Jadeveon Clowney had it out for Carson Wentz.
You know, it's funny, I met an Eagles fan the other night at a party, a gal named Lisa up in Kalispell, and she's like, I don't understand why Philly fans have this rap of being so awful. I'm like, they threw batteries at Santa once, okay? They're Philly fans. I mean, you heard them boo a clear overturn of the catch on Tyler Lockett that was clear as light as day, you know? And it's just mind-blowing. And so it doesn't surprise me that Philly fans would see that play and act like Clowney went out there with a lead pipe and crashed Wentz over the head with it and then pointed and laughed at him. Like, that's how the fans have reacted. And it's like, look, what happened was Wentz starts to get tackled. He's going forward. Clowney goes to put his shoulder in the back of him to make sure he goes down. And also to get a hit in on the quarterback because it's football.
And he's running the ball at that point. He's not in the pocket. He's scrambling.
Right. And by the way, just in the angle of the dangle, the way that Wentz fell and the way that Clowney fell, as Clowney's shoulder hit Wentz in the back, their heads collided. It's not like it sent Wentz's head like with a force of like an amazing impact into the ground. Like he hit it, but it wasn't. I don't know. I've seen much harder hits when it's helmet to helmet, you know, and it is a bummer that it happened to also be that close to the ground so that really they should be more mad at the ground.
If the ground weren't so hard, this wouldn't have happened. I mean, essentially, well,
let's say that Carson Wentz had been 2 feet higher in the air when Clowney hit him the exact same way. Mm-hmm. Wentz doesn't have a concussion.
Yeah, because Clowney gets more into his back, and then he goes sideways rather than gets driven down into the ground.
And his head doesn't go clang off the turf.
And it's not like Clowney can account for gravity and the 2 inches in that short period of time.
You know, it's funny. I mean, a lot of these guys, especially offensive-minded people, they expect every defender to understand the theory of relativity inside and out, as well as Albert freaking Einstein. Like, I mean, if you want to figure out gravitational waves in your free time as a defender, good for you, but I don't think you should be required to. Like, you know what I mean? I don't think you should have to be an expert in Newtonian physics Every time you go to line up a dude for a hit, I mean, make some calculation in your mind to try not to hurt people. But yeah. There's a difference. I mean, Clowney is not Vontaze Burfict.
Right.
Clearly.
Well, and I think there is some history, though, there, because last year, Clowney, face mask Nick Foles, took him down by the helmet. So I think there might be some history there with Eagles fans remembering Clowney. But, you know, it's just from what we've seen from him, he's not going out there and hunting down quarterbacks. And you know what? If Philly fans want to say that that should have been flagged, yeah, well, that's fine. I mean, we see defensive players get flagged for even less than that in sure. some cases. And sure, yeah, flag Clowney, you get the 15 yards, but you're still without wins for the game. I mean, it doesn't change that at all.
Exactly. It isn't a giant difference in the outcome whether or not they flag it. I mean, the difference in the outcome would be having wins continue in the game.
Yeah.
I mean, most likely that would be the biggest thing that you could change in this game to have the outcome become different.
And I think that's, you know, as a Philadelphia fan, you want Wentz in there. And he was playing in his first playoff game. So it is a bummer that he didn't get to finish it out.
It's a total bummer. I mean, when Miles Sanders went down right before the half, I'm sitting there on my couch going, oh, man, this freaking sucks.
Yeah. Well, like, for both our teams, we know how much it stinks to have dudes go down to injury. These were the I saw a stat that these are the two most injured teams to ever play one another in the playoffs since, you know, they started looking at that kind of thing since 1970.
Interesting. Well, I guess there's no coincidence then that the score was 17-9. You know, something as low as that.
Yeah.
But it is interesting to look around the league, Brandon. I mean, the Niners run the hell out of the football. They're in the playoffs and, you know, still playing. The Ravens run the hell out of the football. They're in the playoffs and still playing. And the Seahawks are a running team and they're in the playoffs and they're still playing. The Vikings are a running team. They're in the playoffs and still playing. is it just me or is running the ball important?
It kind of seems like the teams that are kind of good at it are here among the final eight teams. But I, you know, I think a part of it,
but
too,
the analytics say no, go for it on fourth down twice with your backup quarterback.
Well, you know, a part of it could be the shift, too, in the way that defenses, you know, trying to defend more against the pass, getting smaller, which allows teams to be a little more successful running the football.
I have said this for years, and I've been lambasted by a million people, but Lamar Jackson and the Ravens prove this to be true. I believe, in my heart of hearts, to this day, that if the Denver Broncos, coached by Josh McDaniels, with Tim Tebow at quarterback, had committed to playing a jumbo, cram-it-down-your-throat offense and played the type of defense that they have had over the years there in Denver, they would have won a lot of games, if not a couple of Super Bowls, playing that way for the very point that you made just a second ago. The idea that everybody's spreading it out, blah, blah, blah. We need small, fast linebackers and fast, twitchy defensive ends and you know, faster safeties and all that. And then you're able to exploit that. I've said that for years. And they're actually starting to do it now. I do believe to this day, Tim Tebow would have been a successful NFL quarterback for the Denver Broncos had they committed to that.
You can believe that all you want, and nobody can change your mind any differently at this point.
I'm just saying there's a trend in the NFL right now that is proving that out to be true.
And, you know, even when you look at one of the teams that you didn't mention on that list, the Green Bay Packers coming up. And
yeah.
You know, Aaron Jones, when they've run the football with Jones, that's allowed the Packers to have their most successful games. You look at that game where they weren't able to run the ball against the 49ers, and they just get smoked by the Niners.
And that's what's very odd with the Seahawks defense. I have a hard time deciding, are they good against the run, or are they terrible against the run? I honestly can't tell you. They're so Jekyll and Hyde. There are moments when they play very well against the run. You're like, wow, look at that. And then there's, like, against the Eagles, like, they really did kind of defend the run pretty damn well.
Pretty well, yeah.
For the majority of the game. And then you see, like, the Cardinals run all over them. And you're like, oh, I guess they're terrible at it. I don't know. And that will be a gigantic key to that game. What run defense shows up?
It's interesting looking at just how similar these two teams are in terms of you know, pass yards per game, kind of middle of the pack. The Seahawks, 236 passing yards per game. The Packers, 233 rushing yards per game. The Seahawks, 137, but they're without Carson and Penny. And the Packers, 112 yards per game, which is about middle of the league. And then the defense, the differences are passing yards per game. The Seahawks, among the lowest in the league, allowing 263. Packers, 232, about middle of the pack. And then against the run, both these teams, 22 for the Seahawks, 23 for the Packers. And that's overall. I pointed to DVOA earlier with the Packers and the yardage actually lining up. In terms of DVOA, I guess Seahawks are down there too, is among the worst at allowing the run.
Yeah, statistics are difficult sometimes. They just sometimes don't tell the tale. And one of the things that I'm kind of wondering regarding this matchup coming up is after the NFC East, which is by far, I think we can all agree, the worst division in football, mm-hmm. right? What's the second worst division in football in your mind?
In the entire NFL?
Yeah.
I kind of lean AFC South.
So the three that I'm teasing in my mind and trying to figure out which is the next worst, AFC North, AFC South, or NFC North. Like, I mean, the NFC North could be, you could make an argument, the second worst division of football this year.
Yeah.
I understand the Vikings are in the playoffs and they just beat the Saints, but they've been a paper tiger all year.
The Bears finished 8-8.
The Bears are a joke.
They finished 8-8.
They're a joke.
They're an average team.
They're a joke. And once Stafford went down, the Lions were a joke too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I might take that back. I would say the AFC North is your, or the AFC South.
The NFC South, you really only had the Saints at 13-3 and they went out in the first round of the playoffs. And then you had the Falcons, Bucks, and Panthers.
Yeah. So they're equivalent to the AFC North, right? Like one great team and the rest of the teams are a joke.
Or the AFC West.
Yeah. Nobody even cares about the AFC West this year. You know, it's funny. I mean, Saturday came around and it's the start of the playoffs, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know how much interest I had in Saturday football?
I didn't watch Saturday football. I caught the end of the Bills game.
I ended up watching a lot of it only because other people had it on the TV.
Yeah.
Like I wouldn't have chosen to put it on, to be honest. I could give a rip about the AFC this year. It is such a boring conference this year. I mean, just Ravens or Chiefs, take your pick. Those are the only two teams worth a catfish in that conference.
Yeah.
And then we'll see what happens. But the NFC, holy smokes. I mean, you saw it just over the course of this weekend. I mean, it can literally be anybody. It can literally be anybody. I'm not shaking in my boots going to Lambeau to play the Packers. Could we get blown out? Sure. Could we blow them out? Yeah. Could it be a close? I mean, you could give me any scenario against the Packers.
The Vikings could beat the 49ers.
That's plausible.
Yeah, that's what kind of gets me excited about the idea of the Vikings getting that win and now having the NFC Championship still in play as being able to play in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of fun.
It is kind of fun. Dare to dream.
I don't mind it. That's what this time of the year is for. We can look ahead as many games as we want. We can, or we can stew on the fact that the Seahawks haven't beaten the Packers since Mike Holmgren went back there in 1999. The Holmgren curse started. After that game,
we haven't beat the Packers in the playoffs in Lambeau, or just in Lambeau since Holmgren.
So the Seahawks and Packers have played three times in the playoffs. The one game that the Seahawks won, obviously, with Russell Wilson, and then I think it was two games with Hasselbeck where they lost in Green Bay. Obviously, we want the ball and we're going to score game.
Right.
And then 2008 was the other time. Where they lost 42-20. It wasn't even close.
Well, I mean, this is a situation that I think is still a winnable situation for the Seahawks. And we'll get more into that. We're going to do a second show.
We'll try. We'll see what happens. You know, these weeks, you know, how it works out.
All right. Yeah. Because I got to start driving to Denver Wednesday. But it'd be nice to do a second one. I'd like to go back and watch a little more Packers. I honestly haven't watched a ton of Packers this year. For whatever reason.
Yeah, the one game that I remember watching the Packers in was that game against the Niners where I kind of had some hopes that, you know, here are the Packers, a good team coming in to play the Niners, and then they just got whipped.
Yeah, and I wonder a little bit too. I mean, you got to kind of throw out clunkers, you know, your worst game and your best game, and then kind of go back and look through, okay, so what is the bread and butter of this team? And it does seem to be the running game with Aaron Jones. And
they win close games.
A lot of these, especially
down the stretch, they beat the Skins in week 14, 20-15. The Bears, 21-13. You know, there's a one score game or a one possession game. You got the Vikings that they handled the Vikings pretty well in week 16, but then they had to rally to come back to beat the Lions with Blau as the quarterback in week 17.
Right. Right. Yeah, with Blau. Wow. Well, we'll go back. We'll take a peek at it. We'll do a show and you want in the second show this week? We'll do the Welcome to the Flock and some do betters and all that stuff.
Oh, that sounds good. Hey, let's on the way out the door, since I missed it last time, though, for this show.
Yeah.
Let's thank our 1212 subscribers and above.
Great idea.
Keith Kettover, a.k.a. Floctimus Prime, University of Cybertron, Little Flockers, roll out.
DCH from Sparks, Nevada, the University of Montana Grizzlies.
Annalisa Mickelson, a.k.a. Mrs. Doug Baldwin, New York, New York, undergrad, University of North Carolina, Greensboro, graduate school, Brooklyn College.
Eric Trench, rooting for the Seahawks out of Renton, Washington, graduated from Eastern Washington University.
Gary Blum from Chappaqua, New York and the University of Pennsylvania, your 2016 Pick'em League champion.
Ron Pepper, UNLV Runnin' Rebels, San Francisco, California.
Hong Kong!
Ah!
Hong Kong!
Ah!
Hong Kong!
Ah!
Kevin Stengem, Keene, Texas.
Ella Esparza, Woodway, Texas, Yale University and Sam Houston State, Eat 'em Up Cats.
Lisa in Seattle.
Vincent Parker, Emily Carr, University of Art Design, RN Collective.
Samuel Gelber, NoHo, California.
David Van Cleve, Camas, Washington, home of the Papermakers.
Leo Jose, Luleå, Sweden, from Luleå Eskimos and Vancouver, France.
Paul from San Diego.
Hector Delgadillo from Los Angeles, California.
Jameson Holman from Murray, Utah, representing Mississippi State University. Hail State and go Hawks.
Hey Seahawkers, my name is Garen Taylor. I live in one of the most beautiful places in the world, North Idaho. Hashtag on the roads. Go Hawks.
And thanks as well to those of you who haven't submitted your voice intros, starting with Ross in Eureka, California, Christina in Manassas, Virginia, Sven in Berlin, Deutschland, James in Linwood, Roe in Federal Way, Young in Anchorage, Becca in Manhattan Beach, California, Tim in Austin, Kathy in Eureka, California, Jared in Missoula, Joshua in Seven Oaks, England, Brandon in Huntersville, North Carolina, Christian in Bergen, Norway, Jonathan in Ridgefield, Thomas in the Bronx, Glenn in Sanford, Florida, Mitchell in Roseville, California, Keegan in Colorado Springs, Owen in Ashburn, Ireland, Jeffrey in Kansas City, Kari in Rochester, Jeff in Waddell, Arizona, Brian in Berlin, Connecticut, Tracy in Kaneohe, Hawaii, Eric in Seattle, Connie in Gothenburg, Sweden, Taylor in South Cleellum, Lisa in Kelowna, BC, Dean in the Greater Hawkdom, Arvin in Riverdale, Utah, Brian in the Greater Hawkdom, JC in Billericay, England, Scott in Bakersfield, California, Chris in Spokane, Eric in Clovis, California, Kevin in Sammamish, Bryson in Eltopia, Shannon in Florida, John in the Greater Hawkdom, Paul in Minneapolis, Seth in Tacoma, John in New York, Pepper in Greenville, South Carolina, Jake in Tukwila, Shoko in New York, Greg in Seattle, Ryan in Chatham, Kent, Ben in Wrexham, Wales, Jeremy in the Bronx, Joshua in Candor, New York, Kenneth in Hutto, Texas, DK, not that DK, in Ferndale, Washington, Paul in Boston, Mario in Pullman, Jeremy in Moses Lake, Cora in Ditters, Deutschland, Jeff in Monroe, Warren in Dundee, Oregon, Chris in Austin, Amy in Squim, Marcus in New South Wales, Australia, and lastly, Preston in Phoenix. Once again, a huge thanks to all of our $12 subscribers and above for coming in each and every month, helping make this show happen, keeping it ad-free, and if you want to get in the flock, you can do it at getintheflock.com. Always love doing these shout outs each and every month and enjoying the Ring of Honor with all of the flock on Facebook, especially this time of year in the playoffs.
Oh, for sure, man. You guys are the best, and we appreciate it a ton.
All right, Adam. Well, more show later in the week if we can work out a good time for it. And I think with that,
there's only one thing left to say.
Go Hawks.
Go Hawks.